After clambering through communication trenches, Wilson's platoon eventually made it to their assembly trenches north of the Longueval to Bazentin-le-Grand road at around 10:30 p.m. on the 14th of September. It was a cold night, but their attempts to dig funk holes in the side of the trench, where they had to wait for some 8 hours, were terminated abruptly after they found they were unearthing something in a uniform. The bad smell told them it was yet another decomposing corpse, another factor which made Wilson and his comrades long for the waiting to end so they could rush forward. They were not in the foremost assembly trench. The assembly trenches nearest to the Germans were occupied by the 2nd New Zealand Brigade's 2nd Auckland Battalion on the right and the 2nd Otago Battalion on the left. It would be down to them to ensure that the attack began on the right foot. They would not be advancing alone. The assaulting troops from the 15 Corps British 41st Division would be on their immediate right, with troops from the 3rd of the Corps' divisions, the British 14th Division, on the right of the 41st Division. The 14 Corps would be attacking on the 15 Corps' right. There was also to be support on the New Zealanders' left, supplied by the British troops in the 3rd Corps, while the 3rd Corps' left was in its turn to be supported by the Reserve Army's Canadian Corps. The 2nd New Zealand Brigade's advance represented only the first of the attack's four separate stages. At 6:20 a.m. on the 15th of September, this brigade was to make the initial advance to the north with a view to taking Crest Trench, around 150 yards up the slope from its battalion's assembly trenches, before going on approximately 450 yards to capture 950 yards of Switch Trench on the same ridge. At 7:20 a.m., the 3rd New Zealand Rifle Brigade's 4th Battalion was to advance to take the next line of German trenches, around 1,000 yards further north down the other side of the ridge. Then, at 8:20 a.m., the 3rd New Zealand Rifle Brigade's 2nd and 3rd Battalions were to advance north of Flare, paving the way for the brigade's 1st Battalion to seize Grove Alley, the final objective, shortly after 10:50 a.m. The times for the first two of these stages were even more important than had been the case hitherto, since the attackers were to be protected by a creeping barrage. Shells were to rain down just ahead of the advancing New Zealanders, shielding them from any Germans who might be lying in wait in front of the trench being attacked, as the New Zealanders crept forward in the approach to the German trenches. If the four tanks allocated to the New Zealanders' front had materialized in the front line so that their advance could have preceded the infantry, the attack might have proceeded more smoothly. However, 5 minutes before the advance was due to begin, news reached the 3rd New Zealand Rifle Brigade that one of the tanks was out of action, and the remaining three would be late. At 6:20 a.m., when the 2nd New Zealand Brigade's battalions moved forward, they did so without the support of the giant caterpillars from which so much was expected. This had a significant effect on the progress of the 2nd Otago and Auckland battalions. The former was particularly vulnerable, being exposed for that much longer in no man's land, where the men were picked off by the Germans to their left, who were still holding out in high wood. One of the attackers on the right was George Tuck, a 22-year-old carpenter serving in the 2nd Auckland Battalion, who had risen through the ranks to become a 2nd Lieutenant. He has recorded the critical moment, following the lifting of the barrage from Switch Trench, when he saw the lines of men ahead of him stop 20 yards out to throw grenades at the German defenders. Leaderless, because of the number of their NCOs killed or wounded during the advance, they were cowed by the grenades the Germans were throwing at them. They may also have been demoralized by the thinning out of their lines, the consequence of having hugged the creeping barrage too closely. "I scream again and again, don't stop," Tuck reported. He realized the Germans had at that moment a glorious opportunity to repel the assault. But they would have needed to make an impression quickly, for, as Tuck later described it, the massed line of attackers eager to pounce on their tormentors was like nothing more than a great ocean wave raising itself and seeming to hesitate. Straining to seize the initiative, he forced himself onwards and managed to walk down Switch Trench's battered parapet into the midst of their foe. "On my right and left I see some others do the same," Tuck remembered. "Then the great wave breaks over the trench. A terrible scene ensues. I don't use the bayonet. One man recoils from me against another. They both drop to the one shot. I turn about and get the nearest to me, then the next. All this in a few moments. Then our men flood the trench. It was not a fight. It was swift vengeance. The Germans in that trench were from 2 to 3 inches taller than our men. But our men had suffered in the advance. As soon as they entered, the Hun wanted to surrender. I do not blame our men that they would make them fight and die, or not fight and die anyhow." According to Tuck, the initial assault was followed by frenetic activity. while one of his men ran along the trench screaming, "Come on, you bastards! This is man's work! You're not killing women and children now!" Others dug the surviving Germans out of their dugouts, whereupon most of them were dispatched. The scale of the killing following the surrender of the German garrison is partially glossed over by the ambiguous wording in Brigadier General William Braithwaite's report on how his battalion's prisoners were treated. Only 2 Red Cross men and 2 wounded were left alive in the Crest Trench. And in Switch Trench, the only prisoners taken were 4 German officers, he reported. The report filed by the 2nd Auckland Battalion's Lieutenant Colonel Charles Brown was more forthright. No prisoners except wounded were taken by this battalion, as at this stage it was impossible to do so without delaying the operation. Perhaps guessing what was about to happen, some members of the Switch Trench garrison decided discretion was the better part of valour, and ran for their lives. Many of the Germans were mowed down by a Lewis gun that was quickly mounted on the trench parados. Those who were not hit were pursued by New Zealanders, whose lust for blood was too inflamed to stop in the objective they had been set. One such hothead was 21-year-old Walter Graham, a clerk in a loan company before he enlisted, who ended up in the 2nd Battalion, the Otago Regiment, the unit on the left. The following extract from his after-action report explained that the rush of blood to his head came after the German defenders had terrified him. "Our platoon went over in the second wave, and I could see the Germans' heads above the trench firing at us when we got halfway across. Even when we joined the first wave, I could see that our ranks were pretty thin. While we were lying down waiting for the rush, Fritz was rattling away with his machine guns. For a few seconds he ripped up the ground about a yard in front of me. It gave me a bit of a fright, and I wasted no time in wriggling back a few yards. I also yelled out to the man on my left to get back, but when I looked at his face I saw that he was dead. When we stood up and started to run, their fire slackened off and soon stopped altogether. Half of them put their hands up, and some took to their heels. We all wanted to get at them with the bayonet, but some of us were faster than others. I jumped into the Hun trench and found it was so deep I couldn't climb out at the other side, so I pulled what looked like a dead Hun into a sitting position at the side of the trench, stood on his shoulders and managed to climb out. When I think of it now, it was a horrible thing to do, and I'm not quite sure if he was dead or not. I did not notice in the excitement of the moment. I was chasing a fellow and almost had him, but then I found it was not safe as the fellows behind were firing, so I lay down, took steady aim, and shot him. Then another poor beggar came stumbling towards me as if he wanted to surrender. He had a shower of bullets flying around him. I knew that if I let him come too near me, I would stand a good chance of getting hit, so I gave him a bullet in the chest when he was about 15 yards from me. As Tuck and his men dug a new trench around 60 yards past the trench they had just captured, a measure designed to help them escape the worst of the shelling that was bound to follow, the 4th Battalion of the 3rd New Zealand Brigade passed through them, heading for the next objective, which they also took at around 7:50 a.m. That opened the way for the second piece of leapfrogging, with the 3rd New Zealand Rifle Brigade 2nd Battalion on the right and its 3rd Battalion on the left advancing at 8:20 a.m. to attack Flare Trench and Flare Support Trench. Private William Wilson has chronicled how the men in his 2nd Battalion section were temporarily held up by a nest of German machine gunners who proceeded to mow down the advancing New Zealanders. He survived by taking cover in a shell hole, only emerging after he saw that around 12 of his comrades had crawled around to the left and taken the strong post from the side. But it is Wilson's description of what happened next that is so chilling. "The Huns never tried to escape, but threw up their paws, and above the roar of the battle we could hear their cry, 'Mercy, Kamerad, mercy!' But they had done too much damage with their 2 machine guns. Their cry for mercy was never heeded. As I was making for the scene, I saw the bayonet used for the first time. God, it was frightful. But it was all over in a few seconds. Fully a dozen Germans were left lying in their death throes. Some of the Huns tried to run, but they were quickly dropped. One of our officers rushed forward to prevent any more slaughter. He had to threaten our men with his revolver to keep them off." But as the following extract from Wilson's account demonstrates, he was too late to prevent the cold-blooded execution of one of the captured Germans. "As I arrived, a German was on his knees with his hands above his head, begging for mercy. A young chap walked up to him, gazed at him a few seconds, and then deliberately at 3 yards' distance pushed out his rifle and blew the Hun's head practically off." Wilson only accompanied his comrades for long enough to help them take their portion of the next trench. It was empty, the Germans having fled. He was wounded in the leg before they reached their final objective north of Flare. However, Captain Inglis remained on the scene, and he was able to describe the final action of the day. His account mentions the successful use of a tank, which at around 10:30 a.m. finally reached the place where the 3rd New Zealand Rifle Brigade's 3rd Battalion was held up in front of Flare Trench. The tank broke through the wire obstructing their advance. Inglis's account also describes his decision to attack his company's allotted portion of Grove Alley, the final objective for that day, which was designed to protect the New Zealanders and troops from the 15th Corps' other two divisions against any German incursion from the northwest. That entailed his company's left advancing around 600 yards north of Flare, with its right going a further 200 yards, the extra distance on the right being the result of the line classed as the objective facing the northwest. The 15th Corps' other divisions needed protecting because they had also had a relatively successful day, even if they had not broken through to their final objective. The 41st Division's battalions, on the New Zealanders' immediate right, eventually reached the line just north of Flare, which represented the third of their fourth objectives. The 14th Division's performance was more patchy. While its left battalion reached Bulls Road, the third objective, northeast of Flare, its right battalion halted just south of the road. Inglis's account is also to be commended for the way it frankly owns up to the mistakes he made. The most costly error occurred after the 450-yard stretch of Grove Alley they were targeting had been captured, which happened around 11 a.m. As at Switch Trench, when it came to the tipping point, the German garrison of Grove Alley, consisting of around 200 men, had not been willing to stand and fight. Instead, they had bolted. That alone explained the success of Inglis's relatively small force. Had it been held up on the grassy flat plateau over which it rushed forward, the force would have been annihilated by the gunfire coming from the higher ground north of Grove Alley, if not from the alley itself. But the occupation of the alley created a different problem for the New Zealanders. Seeing that Germans were advancing down the gully surrounding Glebe Street to the right rear of the 120 men in Grove Alley, Inglis sent a message to the officer in charge of the newly taken position, telling him to peel off with a platoon to secure the area behind their right flank. "Watching the messenger anxiously, I saw him reach the trench," Inglis reported. However, to Inglis's amazement, when the officer walked back with about 20 men, they were followed by all the other troops in Grove Alley, thereby vacating the trench they had just captured. Inglis somehow managed to stop them retiring back to Flare itself and considered attempting to retake the alley. He only decided against this idea after it became clear that with only two other officers near him, it would not be practical to form them up again in the midst of the German artillery barrage that had descended on the plateau. This was all the more upsetting because Inglis rightly concluded he was to blame for the alley's loss. He should have ensured that the men who were to remain in Grove Alley had been warned about the retirement on their right flank before any movement was attempted. That being said, the New Zealanders had not done so badly. They had advanced almost a mile and a half during the day, which in the static war of 1916 was something of a record. The other mistake had been made as his men advanced through the northern streets of Flare prior to the assault on Grove Alley. When Inglis pointed his rifle down a dugout they were passing, a bespectacled German with a beard who was standing on the steps shouted out, "Nicht schließen! One wounded!" Inglis passed on, but one of his men, whom Inglis described as harder-hearted, was less merciful and lobbed a couple of Mills grenades into the dugout. It was an act that snuffed out any opposition that might have been brewing there, but it was arguably one more war crime to add to all those that had gone before. Nevertheless, Inglis subsequently admitted his decision had been unwise, since, had it not been overridden, it would have left his men a hostage to fortune. No one could tell whether these Germans, left at liberty in their rear, might have attacked his men later. The fear that the New Zealanders might be surprised by German troops left behind in Flare was later shown to be justified, after Private Burley and his comrades in the 2nd Wellington Battalion were attacked while passing through Flare later that night. By then, Flare was no longer the village it had once been. Burley's letter, written from the United Kingdom after he had been wounded and repatriated, describes how, when passing a jumble of broken-down brick buildings, fallen trees, wreckage of all sorts, and hundreds of dead Huns, they were targeted by a hidden German machine gunner who claimed several scalps. What remained of Burley's platoon scoured the area for the culprits, but only managed to capture 4 out of approximately 30 who had been hiding. "These 4 were searched and relieved of anything which we wanted in the way of souvenirs," Burley stated. "I claimed a helmet, a belt and some postcards. Then we were ordered to send them back. But we were all so mad at them killing 6 of our mates and the sergeant that we ended them with our bayonets. I still have the helmet and have managed to keep it with the cards, etc., in the hospital with me, but I had a job to hang on to them. I was ordered to hand them in, but here I am with them in my locker. Lady Curtis, who visits here to represent the New Zealand Contingent Association in South Wales, offered me £5 for them, but I would not part with them. So it was that the ripples made by the No Prisoners lecture, delivered with such relish at the end of August, spread out not only to Flair but also back to the United Kingdom. Civilized ladies wishing to bask in the success of their young men queued up to purchase trophies of their heroism on the battlefield, thus creating a market for goods taken by nefarious means. The women eventually realized the scale of the sacrifice entailed in securing a place like Flair. The New Zealand Division's casualties on the 15th of September, which amounted to in excess of 1,900, could not be concealed forever. But in the short term, at least, only those women whose loved ones' correspondents openly admitted how their pre-war decency had been swept aside by the fighting realized the full cost of going to war. Even the New Zealanders' officers may not have realized the scale of the problem. Captain Inglis, who steadfastly believed that most of his men were incapable of committing deeds on the battlefield which were tantamount to murder, witnessed a scene suggesting that at least some of them might be. While he and his men were carrying out the wounded men they had found lying stranded at the aid post to the rear of Abbey Road during the morning of the 17th of September, he overheard one of the carriers who had just discovered that the soldier on his stretcher was German, saying, "Rob the bastard and stick a bayonet through him." Before Inglis could know for certain whether the suggestion that their charge should be murdered was sincere, he intervened, and the German in question was then carried to the dressing station. But given the other evidence of war crimes by New Zealanders that has been cited, there is a possibility that what Inglis had witnessed was just the tip of a sinister iceberg, which meant that no German prisoner taken into captivity by New Zealanders could be sure he would survive to tell the tale.